Here's one way to think about the American position on global trade right now. Perceived economic benefit in return for possible political costs. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, today the 4th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This is shaping up to be an awkward economic week for the Trump administration. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, as you might have heard, got the cold shoulder at the G7 finance ministers meeting over the weekend. President Trump heads to Quebec, Canada for the leaders meeting this weekend. That's on the heels of blistering responses from Canada and Mexico and the European Union over his steel and aluminum tariffs and his implication that our closest allies are national security risks. Noting that global trade and geopolitics are very close bedfellows, Marketplace's Sabri Benishour starts us off with what the payback might be.
Our allies are not happy with U.S. trade policy.
You'd be amazed how angry people in the rest of the world are about it.
Ken Rogoff is a professor of economics at Harvard. Now, the obvious cost is, of course, measured in dollars. For every $50 billion we tax their goods, they'll tax ours.
There's no question there's going to be a lot of tit for tat.
But there's a strategic cost of antagonizing our allies as well, says Lauren Bosma, an analyst with the Albright Stonebridge Group. For example, remember the whole Trans-Pacific Partnership Asian trade agreement we withdrew from?
I know from my conversations with people in the administration that the removal of TPP has made it more difficult to seek concessions or greater cooperation on certain issues.
There are a lot of issues on which the U.S. could be working with its allies.
Problems of steel overcapacity, the problems in China of forced technology transfer and the misappropriation of intellectual property.
Jeff Schott is a fellow at the Peterson Institute. He says managing North Korea and Iran also become more complicated in the current atmosphere of tension. Lastly, says Albright Stonebridge Group's Lauren Bosma, driving away allies drives away their business too.
As more economic power shifts to Asia, other countries also want to diversify their trade and investment linkages to protect against any further turbulence.
The U.S. can get away with a lot because of its economic power, but that position isn't guaranteed. And if the U.S. doesn't lead its allies, other countries may fill that void. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
So let's back up for a minute here and do an economic origin story of the Trump administration's steel tariffs, shall we? The fact is, and this isn't really in question, that the global economy is producing too much steel. Overcapacity is the word you sometimes hear. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look at why and what, if anything, is to be done about it.
Why do we have a global steel surplus? I can answer that with one word: China. When China started construction on its Three Gorges Dam back in the 1990s, it needed a lot of steel. Michael Montgomery is an economist with IHS Markit.
And dams are massively steel intensive.
Dams are steel intensive, Montgomery says, because they need lots of steel reinforcing bars. China built new factories to make that steel, but didn't close them when the dam was finished. It didn't want to lay off all those steel workers. So China kept making lots of steel, which needed a home, says Paul Nathanson of the Coalition of American Metal Manufacturers and Users.
There was no place for that steel to go domestically, so they started to ship it.
Nathanson says now the U.S. needs to convince China to reduce the flow of steel.
The only way we can do this is to work with our trading partners, not to say we're putting up walls to all steel. You deal with the problem.
Maybe you ask China to mothball a steel plant for just a few months, says Lisa Phillips, a professor of labor history at Indiana State University. Phillips says another solution, faster global economic growth. She says Congress and the White House could jumpstart that with an infrastructure plan.
Then we would purchase more steel, and then that would help with the glut.
Phillips says there'd need to be guarantees that U.S. steel would be used, but also some steel from China to drain away at least some of the global glut. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
It's a common refrain on this program that economic headlines don't mean a whole lot until you understand what they mean on the ground, as it were. Charles Smith is the VP of Operations at Tokuzin USA. That's a tire cord producer out of Conway, Arkansas. Those are tire components that use, in his case, imported steel. Mr. Smith, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you very much, Kai.
First of all, sir, what do you make of all of this with the steel tariffs and the news and the trade impasse, I guess?
Yeah, it's made a really difficult situation for our company. We're paying tariffs on steel that we need to produce the products for our customers in the U.S., while the same products that are being produced overseas are coming in with no tariffs on them at all.
Yeah, just to point out again that the finished goods that are imported pay no tariffs, but the raw materials that you need are tariff impaired, as it were, right?
That is correct. So 25% tariffs that we're already paying have been now for, this will be the second month we've had to pay a tariff.
Can you give me a dollar amount that you're out now or you know are being impacted by?
Well, like, as a private company, privately owned company, we don't disclose our financials, but I'd say it's in excess of, it's going to be in millions that we're going to pay in tariffs.
You need the foreign steel, why, sir? Can you just not find what you need in this country?
Yeah, there's no one that actually makes this quality in the United States. No one's invested in it over the years and to try to develop it. They backed out of that development some years ago. So it's just not available in the States.
What's the status with your exemption request from the Department of Commerce? Do you know?
Well, it's under review, and on the last day of the process for objections, we had some objections that were made at the 11th hour, let's say.
Objections to your exemption?
That's right.
Wow. So now what does that mean? Are you, like, in limbo?
Well, I am in limbo, and we have to wait for the final determination by the U.S. government, but we do have negotiations with legal teams to see if we can resolve some of that. But it's an ongoing process and won't be done anytime soon.
So there are ancillary costs, not just the tariff cost of the steel, but you're paying lawyers and people to do all the paperwork for you too.
Oh, right. We've spent, you know, tens of thousands of dollars on our legal fees already, and it'll be more in the coming months just to get our statement out there and to try to rebut the comments that have been made about the availability of steel in the U.S.
Maybe this is just me, and it's because, you know, we're not sitting in front of each other and we're talking on the phone, as it were. But you sound a little weary.
Yeah, you know, for sure. Weary is a easy way to categorize the way it has made us feel. We feel like we're making progress, and you feel like you're going forward. And then, you know, in the 11th hour, you get the exclusion objection, and you feel like you're going to have to start all over again. You know, you think, okay, well, we've paid all this money, we've filed all these filings, we've talked to the government, we've done everything we could to make a good case. It looks like it's going forward, and then it starts over again. Okay, now we have to answer these objections and try to come to a legal resolution.
Charles Smith, Tokusin USA. They make tire cords for tires. Sir, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
Tire cords for tires. Good job, Kai. Here with an assumption, Wall Street has lost interest in the trade policy back and forth. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Holy cow, the tech news today, huh? Facebook is defending itself against a new round of criticisms about its data privacy policies. Microsoft is buying a big open source code company. And it just so happens today is Apple's annual developers conference. So much to talk about, not a whole lot of time. Molly Wood is the host of Marketplace Tech. We got her on the phone. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai, I'm here for lightning round.
That's right. We're going to bang out a whole bunch of stuff. 3 minutes and 24 seconds left. First of all, the Facebook story was in the New York Times this weekend. Facebook has apparently been sharing some data with apps and other companies. Make me smart on that one, would you?
Yeah, this story was a little confusing. It's basically, though, about how Facebook worked with big phone and tablet manufacturers. And it was about putting Facebook-like features onto devices, phones and tablets, like, let's say, the ability to take a picture and upload it to Facebook, either without opening the app or, frankly, before Facebook apps even existed, before there was an app store. So these are very, you know, in some cases, very old agreements. They started about 10 years ago. Some of them have started to wind down. But what the Times reported is that this went way beyond those basic features and that some of the apps on the devices, like one on BlackBerry phones, were actually able to see, you know, profile information about you, your friends, and maybe even friends of friends. So they did this experiment and were able to see data on 294,000 people.
Wow.
And they said that that was regardless of what your actual permissions were at the time. I should say Facebook said it disagrees with this assessment, that it was the experiences were tightly controlled. And obviously they were different on every device. But, you know, it's just another black eye.
Yeah, it sure is. On the assumption that this predates the Cambridge Analytica stuff, right? Or at least
it does.
So what has changed? What will change? Why should Facebook users on any device or platform or anything have any confidence about their data?
Well, I think that's fundamentally the question.
Right.
Is, you know, and this is the kind of thing where some people in the tech industry are like, on the list of bad things that Facebook has done with our data, this was actually pretty straightforward. And, you know, if you trusted Apple and Samsung and Google, who are pretty good at securing data, you could assume that it wasn't actually being abused. Mm. The problem is, as with so many things, the benefit of the doubt situation is not good. And it's just part of this overall concern that Facebook isn't helping because it's still not that transparent about the stuff that it collects for ad purposes. They talk a lot about sharing and how you can control who sees your post about your grandma, but that is not the same thing as the business model.
Right, totally. All right, we sucked up a whole lot of time on that. I'm in a minute left. We're going to bang out two things. Microsoft is buying GitHub for $7-something billion. Explain what GitHub is, and then the idea that this giant conglomerate is buying this open source code company.
Yeah, GitHub is basically a giant playground for open source coders. It's, you know, where you develop some code for something and you want to share it with the open source community and you put it all up on GitHub. And Microsoft, which, you know, nerds among us will know, has had a long and basically abusive relationship with open source software. Buying GitHub is one of those I never thought I would live long enough to see it.
Oh, that's funny.
Because it used to refer to open source as like one big copyright violation. It's a big change.
Is it a kindler, gentler Microsoft under Satya Nadella?
I think that is what they are trying to tell these developers for sure. And yes, absolutely, they have embraced open source and it's a very different model.
Speaking of developers, super quick, Apple today, the big worldwide developers conference, anything whiz-bang out of there other than, gee, new software and all kinds of new functionality? Anything else?
I'm going to say I was surprised they didn't talk about privacy more.
Yeah.
Considering how much Tim Cook has mentioned it lately, I would have thought it would be a big selling point, and it was not.
Molly Wood, she's a host of Marketplace Tech, also with me, a podcast that we do called Make Me Smart. Thanks, Molly.
Thanks, Kai.
In the public education system in New York City, there are high schools, and then there are specialized high schools. Schools like Stuyvesant and Brooklyn Tech that are so selective, families can wind up paying thousands of dollars to prepare their kids for the admissions test. That can put low-income students and students of color at an admissions disadvantage. And over the weekend, Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York City said he's got a plan to address that imbalance. Marketplace's Amy Scott has the story from the education desk at WYPR.
Nearly 70% of New York City school kids are African American or Latino, but they make up only about 10% of the students in the city's specialized high schools. Chancellor Richard Carranza says the test is part of the problem.
There's a cottage industry preparing students to take this one test for admission to specialty schools. That in and of itself disadvantages especially poor families.
The mayor wants to base admissions instead on a combination of grades and performance on standardized state tests, but that will require changing the law. For now, the plan is to reserve 20% of spots for students from high-poverty middle schools who score just below the cutoff. That would have helped Muhammad Dean, who just missed getting into Brooklyn Technical High School.
I would have been able to take more challenging classes. I would have had, you know, more kids who were taking school seriously, so I could grow, I could challenge myself academically.
Instead, he wound up at a low-performing high school where he's now a senior. Critics of the plan say it could lower standards at schools like Stuyvesant and Bronx Science and disadvantage Asian American students who are overrepresented at those schools. UCLA education professor Pedro Noguera says the city needs more good high schools.
Particularly some of the communities that have been most left behind, there need to be high-performing schools there so that there's not so much pressure on just a handful of schools.
Chancellor Carranza says the city is working to improve all schools. He's just 2 months into the job. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, with Chinese trading relationships so much in the news, here is something different.
So this is a chip that's actually designed in the U.S. and then fabricated in the U.S.
American chips in Chinese phones. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 178 today, 0.7%, 24,813. The NASDAQ gained 52 points. That's about 0.6%, 76.06. The S&P 500 up 12, 0.4%, 27.46. Tech stocks mostly higher. Microsoft up 0.8% on news it's going to buy GitHub, as Molly and I were talking about. Apple also up 0.8% for its Worldwide Developers Conference. Facebook down 0.3% on that report in the New York Times that also Molly and I were talking about. Energy stocks faded a bit in line with easing oil prices. Dominion Energy off 0.1%. ExxonMobil moved down 1%. Chevron off about 1.2%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note, the T-note, we sometimes call it, up to 2.94%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Slabaugh from Columbus, Indiana. Make Me Smart and Marketplace are two of my favorite shows, both pushing me to think outside of my normal boundaries and making issues important to me that I wouldn't have considered before. I became a Marketplace investor because I feel it's important to vote with your dollar for media that makes a difference in the world. To join me as a Marketplace investor, donate today in whatever amount works for you at marketplace.org.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The television ratings of late have not been kind to CNN for all the headlines and presidential rage tweets that it gets. The original all-news cable network trails Fox News and MSNBC in the oh-so-important primetime hours. CNN is hoping to start turning that tide with a new show tonight, Cuomo Primetime, it's called, with their former morning guy, Chris Cuomo. An hour of live, in-depth news and analysis is promised, an antidote of sorts to the back and forth and back and forth and back and forth of most of cable news. Whether it's going to bring the ratings boost and the extra ad dollars that CNN wants and needs, here's Marketplace's Renata Sago.
CNN's marketing for Cuomo Primetime focuses on one-on-one interviews with Washington bigwigs and key players abroad.
Forget about the spin. This is about how we got here.
Daryl West is vice president of governance studies at the Brookings Institution. He says an emphasis on one-on-one interviews has potential to give the network's primetime viewers more of what they may be looking for during the Trump presidency.
People want the background on an issue. They want to go in much greater depth about what is involved. And so the old-fashioned panels where there are three or four people arguing with one another doesn't provide enough depth for people in this current era.
That has been a staple of cable news. So CNN's willingness to try a different approach is probably tied to its ratings. The latest survey from Nielsen shows CNN is losing the primetime cable news race. It's got 944,000 viewers from 8 to 11 p.m. Eastern time. Compare that to 2.3 million for Fox News and 1.7 million for MSNBC. That was the same pattern during the presidential campaign. Robert Thompson teaches television and popular culture at Syracuse University. He points out that the three cable networks have been competing since the mid-1990s.
The overall structural nature of the three race 24-hour cable news situation is the same as it was before 2016.
Pew Research Center found in a study last year that cable networks were the main source of political news for Americans during the 2016 election season. Katarina Evamatsa is associate director for journalism research there. She finds the number of people watching the channels has gone up since 2007 from 2.7 to 4.7 million, and spending on advertising and overall revenue has too, notably during the election.
For the three channels in 2016, they garnered $1.9 billion, and that was up from $1.4 the year before.
Syracuse University's Robert Thompson says in the competitive environment for ad dollars, the personality of news program hosts can give networks an edge.
You've got to keep people coming back even when there isn't a big breaking story, and that means you have to present to them people that they want to see.
Chris Cuomo's got his work cut out for him. He'll share the same time slot with two of the biggest personalities in cable news, Sean Hannity on Fox News and Rachel Maddow on MSNBC. I'm Renata Sego for Marketplace.
Picking up on the broad theme from the top of the program, America's trading relationship with the rest of the global economy, we turn now, and again, to be honest, to China. There's been one company in particular in the middle of the Washington-Beijing spat. It's called ZTE. That's the one you might remember that got slapped with penalties by the Department of Commerce for sanctions violation on the order of $1 billion+. Also the one, though, that President Trump tweeted about saving jobs at. Once you step back from the day-to-day of the trade-related news cycle, though, and consider an actual ZTE device, the actual phone, you can learn a whole lot about the underlying economic and technological relationship between the two countries. Marketplace's Scott Tong was, once upon a time, our China bureau chief. We asked him to explain what is going on.
The U.S.-China relationship is so complicated that sometimes it's nice to have one device to illustrate the essentials. If only we could pry the device open.
One last tab that's giving me grief. There we go.
Kyle Weens is wrestling with a pesky ZTE smartphone. It's like an oyster that won't yield. He's the CEO of the California firm iFixit. He disassembles cell phones for a living to peek at the parts inside.
That's kind of a clever design.
We asked him to take apart the Max XL Android phone from the Chinese company ZTE. It's a lower-end choice, costs $140.
And there we go. We got it open. Okay, so now
the key to any dissection is finding the brain of the species. Here, it's a computer chip that he calls a central processor.
This is the hub. It's the central brain of the device. And Qualcomm designs most of the processors that are in Android phones.
This is the key discovery. The chipmaker Qualcomm is based not in Shanghai or Shenzhen, but San Diego. The most critical, highest tech piece of this Chinese phone is American.
In this case, this is a Qualcomm Snapdragon. So this is a chip that's actually designed in the U.S., a base design that comes from the U.K., and then fabricated in the U.S.
This makes for great angst in Beijing. It shows the Americans are generations ahead in semiconductors and other technologies. In mainland factories, the critical parts in routers, cars, even airplanes are often imports from places like the U.S. The Chinese government wants to end this dependence, says Damian Ma of the Paulson Institute think tank in Chicago.
Techno-nationalism has a long and stellar history in China. During Mao's time, they've always wanted to have some semblance of technological self-sufficiency.
So China's spending tens of billions of dollars to develop homemade core technologies. IT, robots, biomedicine, cyberspace. You might call it China's cyberspace race to win the future. It wants to win in 5G, the underlying wireless communication standard of tomorrow.
It's like building the highways to support, the automobile industry. So you got to build that brand new infrastructure to support the next information economy.
But Trump administration officials call the Chinese plans frightening and a reason for tariffs. Some academics fear mainland domination of high-tech sectors. But tech analyst Sam Sachs of the Center for Strategic and International Studies says there's a big difference between Chinese rhetoric and ability.
That rhetoric is removed, I think, from a lot of the day-to-day frustration of these industries still lag 1 to 2 generations or more behind.
She says the problem in Chinese plans is that they're top-down. The government picks winners rather than the market, which may work with T-shirts and shoes, but not this.
When you're talking about the really cutting-edge areas in integrated circuits, for example, there's a level of know-how, years and years of investment in R&D that's difficult.
To be fair, smartphone expert Kyle Weens at iFixit says leading in semiconductors is a really hard technical challenge.
This is the pinnacle of human technology. This is the result of thousands of years of technological advancements. This is one of the hardest things that we have ever made as a species.
If it sounds like he's talking about going to the moon, perhaps that's the point. China and many in the U.S. are treating this tech competition as the new economic space race. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Scott mentioned Qualcomm, by the way. We had the CEO of that company, Steve Mollenkopf, on the program not too terribly long ago. You can hear it on our Corner Office podcast.
This final note on the way out today, before which these two stipulations. Number one, Howard Schultz didn't actually found Starbucks, contrary to conventional wisdom. Number two, he is totally running. The company announced today Schultz is going to be stepping down as executive chairman. Here's his quote on it. I will be thinking about a range of options for myself, from philanthropy to public service, but I'm a long way from knowing what the future holds, end quote. Schultz's name was tossed around a couple of 3 years ago, quite liberally, in point of fact, as a possible presidential candidate. Hey, look at the time. We got to go. Dow up 178 today, 0.7%. NASDAQ up 52 points, 0.6%. S&P 500, 12 points to the good. That is 0.4%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow. Bye. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.